Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for coming. I'm not going to give you long introductions. I think you come here to hear about the poll. I do, however, want to thank both Ken Ballin and Matt Warshaw for the work they've done here and for the survey they've conducted. And Ken is going to present for about 15 minutes. John Alderman, the head of our Middle East section, is going to make some intelligent and insightful comments, and then I'm going to make comments, and then we will open things up to the floor. I'll make the point twice. If you look around, there are a lot of people in the room. That means there are probably going to be a lot of questions. If I may ask you the favor, do make it a question, not a speech or a statement. We all know what a question ends with. It's a question mark. And if we could make it one question rather than a six-part question with subclauses, that would be. So as you're thinking up what to ask, I'd be grateful. We will be passing microphones around. If you'd wait for the mic, that would help. And I would be very grateful if you'd identify yourself when you ask a question. And beyond that, I'm going to let Ken plunge right into it and get to the substance of why we're here.
Thank you very much, Tony. Thank you, John. Thank you to the staff of CSIS for putting this on. I very much appreciate it. When we step back and look at Iran, we know what the government thinks. We hear it loud and clear every day. But do we really know what the people think? We have two images, I think, of Iran in the United States. One is the image that's been propagated since 1979 and the hostage crisis of a population driven by radicalism, sworn to view the United States as the great Satan and imbued with fundamentalism at every level of society. The other image, though, frankly, we have of Iran comes from people who have visited Iran, from scholars, experts, and many here in the Iranian-American community, of a country that's really pro-Western, indeed pro-American, that has no faith in the leadership that rules them and wants a very different society. Well, where is the truth? It's difficult to get at the truth. Public opinion surveys that are scientifically based and empirically valid in Iran are rare. The last one to ask the kinds of questions we did was in September of 2003, and what was the result? The pollster was put in jail. So it's not something that occurs every day. We've done it, and the bottom line is this, ladies and gentlemen. Both sides have some truth in it. The side that tells us there's a lot of fundamentalism and an anti-American feeling among the population, and also people who report back on a nation that's open to the West and open to the United States. Both are true. I would say for most Iranians, the latter is more true, but there are important caveats to remember as we look at it. So the bottom line is we see widespread discontent with the state of the economy in Iran. We see as well a feeling of wanting to be open to the West and the outside world, and a rejection, an opposition to the current system of the unelected rule of the supreme leader, which keep in mind that Iranians answered that question in that way. If you take away something, I think that's very significant because that is a red line in Iran. You don't criticize the rule of the supreme leader. You don't criticize his right to rule. And Iranians over the phone, keep that in mind, over the phone, said to us that they oppose that system in favor of a democratic system. So let me go through with you in a little more detail some of our findings specifically. Well, there we go. Well, first, the poll was, we did it as terror-free tomorrow, and it was managed by D3 Systems. And since they're sitting right here in the front row, I've got to give them the plug, www.d3systems.com. Now I can talk to them after the event. I guess I should also say this. that our website is terrorfreetomorrow.org, www.terrorfreetomorrow.org. So as long as I'm plugging D3, I'm going to plug us. The poll was done by telephone from a neighboring country. It was representative of all 30 provinces of Iran. And indeed, if you delve into the demographic data that is up on our website, you'll see this poll really reaches out through every segment of Iranian society and is not limited to the Tehran elite. Thank you, Tom. Other way. Question people have, well, what people have telephones in Iran that would make this a statistically valid survey? Yes, indeed, they do. The landline penetration is 90%. So it's very, very similar to conducting a survey in the United States in terms of the statistical validity of the survey. Okay, people are interested in nuclear weapons. What do Iranians think about nuclear weapons? If you ask them straight out, do you favor nuclear weapons or oppose nuclear weapons, they're split. A slight majority favor nuclear weapons, and 42% oppose it. The same numbers would feel more safe in an Iran that had nuclear weapons. That's an important consideration. Is this a priority for Iranians? Let's put this into context. No, it isn't. Only 33% strongly favor nuclear weapons. Look at nuclear energy. 78% strongly favor that. Nearly a 2-to-1 margin. Here's the important thing. If there's an outside opening, if there's aid and trade from other nations, you see the support from nuclear weapons drop precipitously down to just 17%. So this is what we call in the trade soft support. And here on the next slide, you can see that what do Iranians want? Well, a variety of things. And 80% of them trade and investment from other nations. They would favor full inspections and a guarantee that Iran would not either develop or possess nuclear weapons if they receive from other countries trade and investment in the energy sector specifically for peaceful nuclear energy purposes or for humanitarian assistance. This is the question that I really think puts in context people's view on nuclear weapons in Iran. 88%. 9 out of 10 people, the economy should be the very important top priority for their government. Almost half say Western trade and relations, support for Hamas and Hezbollah, which I'll talk about more because that's an interesting insight into the Iranians' point of view. 33% nuclear weapons in last place at 29%. United States, 68%. Almost 70% of the people said they favor full normal trade and relations with the United States. 24% oppose. The number's even higher with peaceful nuclear energy. Let me put a bit of, well, the next slide puts a footnote on that a little bit. A majority favor their government giving full transparency and inspections to the United States to guarantee that there are no nuclear weapons being developed. 55% would endorse recognizing both Israel and Palestine, a two-state solution, and nearly two-thirds would support ending Iranian support for armed militias inside Iraq. You notice the 51% is lower than the 80% that they were willing to give to other countries. There's definitely... While there are a majority of Iranians are open, and we'll discuss this issue of how pro-American they are, clearly that number drops from 80% to 51% when it's just giving the inspections to the United States. More on that later. To me, the most significant finding of this poll is how Iranians answered over the phone. They don't know who's on the other end of the phone, by the way. When asked about what system of government they want for their country. 61% told us they would oppose, they do oppose, the unelected rule of the supreme leader. 27% favored that. Even more significantly, 79% favored a democratic system where all their leaders, including their supreme leader, is elected. You drop down to 14% would oppose a democratic system where all their leaders are elected. A small number, a number that reveals that faith in the Iranian system currently as set up is quite low among the people, quite low. Well, let me put some caveats. I started out by saying there are two views of Iran. One is a country full of rabid radicalism and another country full of equally strongly held pro-American feelings, and neither view is right. It's a mix. Although the latter view is more correct and closer to the mark than the popular misconception most Americans, I believe, have of Iran. But some caveats. While the vast majority of the people oppose the present system, there's still a significant minority that support it and support President Ahmadinejad's policies. Almost two-thirds of Iranians support financial assistance to Hamas, to Hezbollah, and Iraqi Shiite groups. However, is that a priority for Iranians, that their government support those groups? It is not. Only a third view that as a priority. 88%, if you recall, view the economy as the priority, top priority, and 47% view Western relations as a priority. The United States fares less well than other countries. By a nearly 2-to-1 margin, people want trade and relations with France, European Union, and China, more so than with the United States. Similarly, in terms of humanitarian assistance, they would rather have that from France, European Union, even on some measures Great Britain, which has been a long-time bugaboo in the Iranian mind. So what do we take from all of this? Well, I'm going to leave some of the policy conclusions to Tony and John to draw out of this survey. What I would say is this, though, that as we move forward in dealing with Iran as a government, this poll gives us two important lessons. One, that the most important ally the United States potentially has is the Iranian people. The Iranian people, nuclear weapons are not their priority. An economic renaissance is. An opening to the world is. We would be well advised, however, to approach Iran not in a unilateral sense, because other nations such as France, perhaps Germany, the European Union, even China, if we can coordinate with them successfully, frankly have more credibility among the Iranian people. But the United States, of necessity, will be in a leadership role. And what we must do, above all, it seems to me, is not neglect the will of the Iranian people, not neglect popular opinion. Is it going to change the government in Iran overnight? Absolutely not. I don't think anyone sees that in an immediate future. Although I will say this, this poll occurred before the gas rationing now in Iran and before the riots that we saw from that. And you see this widespread discontent with the economy, even before. I dare say if we did a poll now, it would be higher. But the point to have is as we formulate policies, as we figure out ways to deal with Iran, we need to put front and center the views of the Iranian people. We need to speak directly to them. And that doesn't only mean saying we're going to have military action against your country or we're going to have sanctions. There's a place for sanctions. Obviously, we're dealing with a difficult regime. But it is time the United States begin to take into account the popular will, the feelings, the public opinion of the countries that we deal with, and specifically Iran as we move forward, because this is an ally, a potential ally that we have not engaged. And that doesn't mean trying to foment revolution. It means supporting the views front and center of the people as we move forward to deal with them and to formulate policy. Thank you.
Ken, thank you very much. And let me turn things over to the head of our Middle East program, John Alderman.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to see you all today. I want to congratulate Ken on a really fascinating poll. I encourage you all to dig into it. There's a lot of interesting nuance here and a lot of things that I actually found sort of surprising, given what we have thought the conventional wisdom about where the Iranian people really are. I think the first question is, why should we care about public opinion in Iran? Iran's not really a democracy. I mean, why does public opinion matter in authoritarian states? It seems to me that public opinion does matter in authoritarian states on certain kinds of issues. On issues of national security, I think public opinion matters less, quite frankly, because governments are assumed to have responsibility for national security, and national security in this country and in other countries is the province of elites. But on issues of how do they feel about the economy and the system, how do they feel about their peers, how do they feel toward other kinds of societies and civilizations, do they feel pulled together or pulled apart? I think those are issues where mass opinion really does matter. We have, in this country for the last several years, been working on the assumption that there is tremendous opposition to the government in Tehran, to the governmental system, and tremendous support for the United States. And we have taken policy decisions based on the assessment that there's sort of an incipient pro-Americanism in Iran. I think it's important, based on these kinds of findings, to reevaluate some of those assumptions. Before getting into the specific findings as well, I think it's also fascinating to note the surprising frankness that comes across in this poll. When I was in Tehran 7 years ago, people used to take the batteries out of cell phones when they talked to you because there was an assumption that if the battery was in, the cell phone was actually being used as a bugging device and people were listening to the conversation. That people would tell upwards of 70% of the population would say, you know, the Supreme Leader stuff doesn't really work for me, over the phone to some unseen person who may well be part of the security services, I think tells you that there's something going on. There's a sort of bravery. It also tells you, I think, that our assumptions have been grounded in elite opinions, in people who live in North Tehran and deal with foreigners all the time and deal with the security services in a different way. And there's not that fear going all throughout the society. I think, again, it's an important kind of corrective to how Iran works, and it's only this kind of polling, only these kind of results, sometimes very surprising results, that can help us understand how that works. Economically, there are a bunch of economics questions in this poll. I found it surprising that 42.3% of the people said the economy is headed in the wrong direction, 79.7% said the economy is fair to poor, and 66.4% say their personal economic situation is better or the same. There's a sort of economic malaise which isn't based on people's personal experience completely, but is a sense that the economy is headed in the wrong direction. I think this gives a lot of texture to what we understand, which is people feel not so much that they're doing worse in absolute terms, but everybody else is getting rich off an oil boom and we're not. Right? People look around the world and they know what global oil prices are, and they say, you know what, we see the growth in the Gulf, we see the growth in other places, why isn't this reaching us? And here's the sort of expectation gap, which I think that this difference highlights. I was surprised, quite frankly, at the depth of support for Hamas, Hezbollah, and Islamic Jihad. What one hears from elite discussions is these aren't Iranian issues, Iranians don't care, these are issues that the government of Iran pushes to try to give Iran more credibility with nationalists in the Middle East. These aren't authentically Iranian, and they will go away. And I think when two-thirds of the population supports, either strongly or modestly, the money for Hamas and Hezbollah and Islamic Jihad, you can read all the discussions in the New York Times about people whining that how come the money's going overseas and it's not going to us. But the fact is that a lot of Iranians think this is a decent use of money. This is a proper use of money. again, this is the kind of, I think this kind of polling is important to keep in mind when we think about where Iranians really are. On the nuclear issue, there are a lot of questions about the nuclear issue and dividing nuclear weapons from nuclear power. We see a lot of Iranian interest in nuclear power. What I think we've not been well served by the American media about is the issue that there actually is a very good rationale for Iranian nuclear power because of their problems in the general petroleum sector. I was talking to somebody in the oil business yesterday who said Iran, which has vast supplies of natural gas, doesn't export any gas over the winter because they use it all for consumption. I mean, this is a country that it would make economic sense to have civilian nuclear power. The government's talked about the importance of civilian nuclear power, and the people have signed on to the importance of civilian nuclear power. I think where there's the wedge, and this poll highlights it very, very successfully, there's not nearly the support for nuclear weapons. The government said, we don't want nuclear weapons. We're not supporting nuclear weapons. It's improper to use nuclear weapons according to Islamic law. I think here is a wedge issue that Western powers, China also, which is opposed to an Iranian nuclear program. This is where the international community can push. On the one hand, pushing, yes, we want you to have civilian power. But it has to be civilian power under a framework where it doesn't become threatening to the neighbors. Another issue I thought was surprising, and Ken highlighted this a little bit, is we've sort of been led to believe that there's this incipient pro-Americanism in Iran, that nobody believes the government broadcasts, that everybody, you know, everybody would immediately get in line for a visa to the United States if there ever were a consulate open in Tehran. Sense that they're just waiting for the ability to express their deep love and appreciation for our country. That's simply not borne out by this poll. The traditional bogeyman of Iranian politics is the British. The British are thought to be manipulating Iranian politics, or thought to be manipulating Iranian politics for much of the last century. And to top it off, you don't really get anything from Britain. I mean, Britain's not the great prize. So traditionally, I think the British have often borne more of the brunt of the hostility than the U.S. has. But you don't really see support for the U.S. You see much more support for Russia and China and other kinds of countries. There's a question about, as Ken suggested, do you favor or oppose normal trade relations? With the U.S., 33% of the people strongly favor normal trade relations, about 11% somewhat favor it, but 38.9% strongly oppose it. That's a big number of people who oppose it. There's a question in the poll, a very interesting one, about if there were a hospital ship to give assistance to the Iranian people, should they allow it to dock and give people assistance? And on the U.S. side, it's surprising. 42% say yes, 47% say no. We won't take medical assistance from the U.S. The splits for other countries, China is 75-15, the EU is 72-17, and Saudi Arabia is about 73-17. I mean, that to me highlights a surprising divergence from our assumption that they really love us, that they distinguish between the U.S. people and the U.S. government, that there's really that the government propaganda only makes them like us more. I think if you look at the support for Hamas and Hezbollah, you look at the anti-Americanism, you look at the skepticism, that on the non-elite level, a lot more people buy into the government message. And we have a lot more work to do if the idea is that this is a society of people who are ultimately pro-American. I think what all of this means, I think one issue is there have been some people in the U.S. government who either say we should have a military strike in Iran and people would then use the opportunity to take down the government. We should do various things because this is a society that is on the verge of collapse, and then it would turn pro-American. We should create the kind of conditions where there'd be a huge amount of public pressure to fix the U.S. relationship. I think if you look at all these things, we don't really see that seed of pro-Americanism, of support either for the American people or for the U.S. government, that I think many people have assumed is there in Iran. So I think a very, very important conclusion. The other thing, as I suggested before, is on the nuclear issue. there is a tremendous amount of Iranian popular support for a civilian nuclear program. And we've been quiet about it, and some of the Gulf states have said, well, we're going to oppose Bushehr on ecological grounds because, you know, nuclear power in Iran is a precursor to nuclear weapons in Iran. We want all of it. So the way we're going to deal with nuclear weapons is by opposing nuclear power. And what this suggests to me is that we have a lot more space to push the Iranians on the one hand, supporting civilian nuclear use under a lot of safeguards as a way to continue to oppose and push back against the nuclear weapons thing. There's not support for nuclear weapons. We shouldn't allow ourselves to be marginalized, to have Iranian opinion turn against us, when actually on the issue of both nuclear power and nuclear weapons, we're with the bulk of Iranian public opinion, and we should get there, and we should try to have it work both in this broader segment as well as in the elites toward pushing to the kind of policy outcome we're looking for. Thank you.
Thanks very much, John. What I would really like to address is not the public opinion poll, but some caveats about public opinion. But before I do that, I'd like to congratulate both Ken and what D3 Systems have done, because I think this is the kind of polling that does provide a lot of insight. And for all the reasons both Ken and John have outlined, public opinion polls are very valuable. I also think what is important here is transparency. You have to actually read the polls to understand them. The summaries lead you into the issue, but you have control questions. You often have contradictions in the data. I, over the years, have really never seen an accurate press summary of a public opinion poll that bothered to list the caveats and the uncertainties in the poll. What you get is the punchline, but it's almost always the punchline reflected in ways which omit the limits of what you're seeing. And I have to say that there is a very unfortunate tendency in the United States government recently to actually put out public opinion poll data where you don't know when the collection occurred, you have no idea what the source is, you can't access the data, and people draw conclusions where you have no ability at all to know what the control questions are. We need to think long and hard in groups like USIA, the State Department, and the Department of Defense. But an unsourced public opinion poll is not a public opinion poll. A public opinion poll without methodology and out of context is what we used to call propaganda. And here I do have to congratulate what Ken and D3 Systems have done. I think it's also important that sometimes when you break out public opinion polls by region and by class, by the demographics John and Ken have mentioned, you get very different results. And we found this in another poll done by ABC on Iraq. The minute you took out the Kurdish zone in Iraq, a lot of the public opinion data became far less favorable, a lot less stable. And that was obvious. The Kurdish zone was more secure. But when you have a national poll that doesn't tell you, when you're in the middle of a counterinsurgency and civil conflicts, what people think in the areas where the conflict is occurring. And this is the reason to sort of parse out this data. One of the striking results in that poll on Iraq was that the primary threat most people saw was not the insurgency, but the militias, because the militias actually were more present, and the United States and the coalition, because every day Iraqis have to worry about checkpoints and about house searches, where the bombings, horrifying as they are much more sporadic. And I think this is something which is particularly important here, because remember what Iran is today. There is a very public set of war scares. This is a country whose training exercises, its efforts with the besieged, the mobilization base, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, its military, have structured themselves over the last few years to deal with the risk of an American attack and an American invasion. That has been a very real aspect of society. It doesn't have the kind of constant attention, but it does shape public opinion in ways which are very hard to measure. It's also, I think, dangerous to talk about measuring elites. One problem with elites is the elites you meet are the elites that are public. Do you really poll Iranian religious leaders? Do you poll the senior officers in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard? Can you poll people in the security and the intelligence services? Can you poll the people around the supreme leader and the prime minister? And the answer, unfortunately, is no. But one key issue here is in a relatively repressive state, one which is arming and shaping its military forces, those are the people who have the guns. They are the people who have the money, and they are the people who have the power. And so when you have the elite without the money, the guns, and the power, almost inevitably, when you poll people, you get one set of insights that is different from the people in control. I think that for all the reasons that Ken and John have mentioned, that doesn't make polls any less important, but let's remember the context. I think a point I would reinforce is the essential humanity of what the poll says. I'm not sure how many Americans really do believe that Iranians are in any sense fanatic, anti-American supporters of terrorism or extreme. I don't think any people really fits that characteristic. I can remember after 9/11, there was the same attitude toward the Saudis. And looking at a commercial poll, the primary concern of the Saudis, strangely enough, was with the economy, with jobs, with education and medical services. Now, I can't think of any other country in the world that might have those priorities. Let's be honest about this. Ordinary people are rarely fanatic or extreme, although they can be driven to that. A couple of other cautions. I don't dispute the results on nuclear weapons at all. But remember that Iran's leaders have denied they are seeking nuclear weapons. They have not attempted to provide open support from the people for this. In fact, they've taken just the other extreme. Nuclear power is good. We're not actually getting nuclear weapons. People are conspiring against us to charge that a peaceful program is a weapons program. So how many Iranians who follow the leadership believe they're deeply committed to nuclear weapons? Well, in Iran, the answer is probably a fair amount because nobody really believes their leaders, at least from my own experience having worked there anyhow. But it is an important point. The other thing is when you ask somebody, are you in favor or against nuclear weapons, nobody knows what that means. They don't know what kind of forces people would recreate, how they'd be deployed, the context in which they'd be used, what the response would be. Understand this is a powerful indicator of today. But it doesn't mean that you are going to face serious problems in going ahead with a nuclear program in the short run, or that the people who support nuclear weapons are going to support them when they see the consequences and the possible response. I think that John hit on a key issue, that is Iranian support for the United States. Other polls by the Pew Trust, polls actually D3 did in Iraq, simply reflect a reality. Over the last 6 years, confidence in the United States, belief that we mean what we say, that we are pursuing democratic objectives, has declined sharply all over the world. There's no reason it shouldn't decline in Iran. To ignore those trends, which have been very consistent in every poll overseas by virtually everyone who's conducted it, is dangerous, not only in Iran, but far more generally. So there is another message there. I get a little concerned, however, when we start polling people on democracy. Democracy and peace. Well, who's against peace? The problem is everybody wants peace on their terms, at their rate, and in their way. If you can't figure out what kind of peace people are in favor of, having people be in favor of peace is a dangerous assumption. And it, in general, may not matter. If you are in a society driven by extremes with ambitions on the part of its leadership that differ from how people broadly perceive peace, public opinion in favor of peace rarely matters. Public opinion was probably in favor of peace when Germany invaded Poland inside Germany. Certainly that seems to have been the reaction as nearly as anyone can tell. It scarcely helped. So this has to be kept in context. The same is true of democracy. Everybody wants democracy if that means it asserts their goals and interests. What is a lot harder is to be in favor of sharing power or giving up power if people vote against you, particularly if you've never had to deal with it. And to one point about the Supreme Leader, technically speaking, the Supreme Leader is indirectly elected. How many Iranians know or care when they react to questions about the Supreme Leader? I don't know. But it's hard to put this in nuance. A couple of other issues. I am not surprised by the Hezbollah and Hamas reaction. It is not a matter of one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. Seen from an Iranian perspective and the perspective of perhaps too many other people in the region, Hamas, Hezbollah are seen as the only active resistance to Israel. Hamas is seen by at least some people as a victor against Israel simply because it survived. That may be a totally unrealistic perception, but inevitably Syria and Iran are known to have supported the Hezbollah, and there is the feeling of victory, of somehow after all these years having achieved something. It may not be a real achievement, but it is an important issue. I'm not going to belabor the point about regime change, but I think it's a key one. The truth is, I suspect that an overt American funding of a covert American effort at regime change has probably hurt us in public opinion, but that's not a question anyone could possibly ask in a public opinion poll. A couple of points I would just raise here. What are some of the great uncertainties you can't poll because it would be impossible? The fear of U.S. attack, how real it is in Iran, how serious. What would happen if a U.S. attack did occur? Would you see it as liberating? Would you see it as a threat? Would you support the government? In practice, once you start a war or you start a campaign, that's when public opinion takes on potentially a very different character. How much fear is there of Israel attack or preemption in Iran? I have to believe people do take that seriously. How much or what are Iranian popular concerns with Iraq? How much of that is the reason for anger at the United States? Other polls have suggested that the Iraq war and the Muslim perception that the United States is anti-Muslim in conducting the war on terrorism have replaced anger at U.S. relations with Israel. But it's not clear anybody can parse out those three factors. And I raise this because, as Americans, we really need to think these issues out. We have to look beyond what is pullable and consider, A, what we can't pull, and B, unfortunately, in authoritarian states, the elites are not suppressed liberals and advocates of democracy. As I say, they're the people with the power, the people with the money, and the people with the guns. With that, let's open things up to questions.
Can I just make two quick comments on both your remarks?
Please.
I'm sorry. I just had two very brief comments before we open it up. One, I agree with everything that John said. I would interpret it a little differently. And this picks up on Tony's comments. And we've conducted now, Terror Free Tomorrow, some 23 surveys over the past 2 years around the Muslim world. We see tremendous anti-American feelings in a lot of countries, as the Pew polls and other polls have documented. In that context, particularly in the region, If you look at Turkey, Jordan, the West Bank, Gaza, Egypt, I would say the pro-American feelings in Iran compared to those are very high, actually. So I, you know, it depends on whether you look at the glass as half full as or half empty. Clearly, they're not the feelings towards the United States are I would characterize it as filled with skepticism compared to other countries. But the level of pro-Americanism I see in this poll, after polling elsewhere in the region, is actually quite high. On the Supreme Leader, the question was fairly specific, and I, as Tony said, I would commend you to the actual data. What we asked was this: what option would you favor for governing Iran? A political system, and I'm reading the question, where the Supreme Leader rules according to religious principles and cannot be chosen or replaced by a direct vote of the people. That's the current system. People said they opposed it. A political system where the Supreme Leader, along with all leaders, can be chosen and replaced by a free and direct vote of the people. That's where 80% said they wanted that. This is a red line in Iran. This is not a minor thing to say that you oppose the current religious rule. This is a significant statement by the people in a poll that reached throughout Iran. Interestingly enough, if you listen to some folks, there's a longing for return for the Shah. Our poll did not find that at all. 80% do not want a monarchy and do not want to go backwards in time.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to ask you again to wait for the mic and identify yourself, and therefore I'm going to point to the tall gentleman in the front row.
I'm Patrick Clawson of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. A question, Mr. Bailyn. The U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control has on its website a ruling which states, quote, "The conduct of surveys and interviews in Iran constitutes a prohibited export of services to Iran. It would be contrary to current U.S. government policy to issue a license authorizing such an export of services," end quote. That is specifically about conducting telephone polling in Iran. I think that's an absurd ruling. My question is, did you have any contact with OFAC about whether or not this survey could be done?
Well,
and what do you think? Let me ask you to follow on. What do you think about this ruling by OFAC?
Well, my understanding is, first of all, I disagree, because that ruling relates to surveys inside Iran.
No, it's conduct a telephone poll. Read the letter. It's a telephone poll. It's specifically.
Gentlemen, Pat, I think.
Pat, just.
Give him a chance to ask the question. The debate, interesting as it is, will have to be external. Please.
No, it refers to polling from the United States being exported to Iran. So, our poll was not conducted from the United States.
What about the question on the wisdom of this particular?
It has no wisdom.
All right. Second row, please.
Yeah, Howard LaFranchi with the Christian Science Monitor. Mr. Bailyn, and perhaps John also, but just given what you found and given what you see in the poll, what does that suggest to you about U.S. policy currently? I believe it was $75 million that was appropriated last year for pro-democracy work, working with unions and other pro-democracy groups in Iran. What is the impact of that, given what you find about public opinion?
Well, I think the public opinion is clear. I'm not sure. I've spoken to Iranians involved in that effort and inside Iran, and I'm not sure that the. I think there's a. We have to draw a distinction between what the public wants and what is the best way of America supporting that, and. What I think is one of the best ways we can support that is tell the people of Iran, we're in favor of economic aid, we're in favor, have the carrots out there in a public way that the people seem to want. All you hear from the American government usually is the sticks. We need the sticks, we need the sanctions, but we also need to be more public about responding to what people in the country actually think, and that's how I would answer that question. I don't know whether, John, you had a...
Yeah, The closer people are to actually living in Iran, the more concern I've had about an overt U.S. campaign to promote democracy for fear that it is the cover, as Tony suggested, for a covert American campaign, which actually ends up being counterproductive. I think there is a great limit to what expatriates can do in terms of domestic politics. And this is a program that, to my mind, appears much more attractive to expatriates than to Iranians who, in a slow and sometimes excruciating way, are trying to modify the way they live in their own country.
I have to say, just to follow up, I think, first, the recent arrests in Iran have given you a signal that if you use this kind of program unwisely, you make it very difficult for people to have a dialogue in Iran. You make it harder for Iranians to visit the United States. You end up with some of the most reputable Iranian-American scholars that I know of being arrested and held on charges that make no sense. You validate hardliners. You validate a regime which, by its very nature, is conspiratorial and in some ways paranoid in dealing with these problems. It's also a fact that when you visit people in the Gulf or you talk to Iranians, they pick up not only on this, but they pick up on articles that talk about American special forces operating in Iran. And they see this as something of a conspiracy. And I think there are many people in the audience here who do go out to the Gulf and the region. It also fuels the idea that the United States is about to invade or launch a war against Iran, which is something that you hear when you visit Gulf countries, as if it was imminent in spite of all the problems we face in Iraq. And I think the danger here is not that we should not have programs to reach out to Iranians, but the way the program is conducted, it is seen as regime change and regime overthrow, regardless of how the U.S. may describe it. And it is a very dangerous, negative program which does more to aid the regime than hurt it. Third row. Could you wait, Jim, please?
Oh, sure. Jim Morrow, Broadcasting Board of Governors. I'm wondering if you can tell which way these attitudes are going in Iran. And the one way you can do that, look at the age distribution. Are the younger generations more pro-American? Are the older who knew the Shah? Are the younger generations more in line with the current leadership? Are they educated in the schools, you know, and brought to understand the current leadership more? And another question related to that is, do you know anything about the 39% that refused to answer the poll at all, and how it might affect that?
Ken? Yep. No, I actually the refusal rates were really quite low when you compare them to a poll in the United States where only about 10% of the people typically answer it. And the refusals were for the normal reasons that you would find in a poll in America. I got laundry on the line. I'm in the middle of dinner. I don't like to answer people on the phone. It was that kind of thing. We did not pick up any great resistance to answering the questions. And your second question was, were there dramatic differences across ages? And the answer, surprisingly enough to me, because we often hear how the younger generation is very distinct from the older, their older people. We didn't see that in the poll. I mean, there were some variations, but it was not wide, and I wouldn't say it was overwhelmingly indicates that the young people feel one way and the older people feel a different way. And the answer to that is no, I would say. So that the idea that somehow the younger people are more pro-American or more anti-American or more pro-Western or not, the differences weren't dramatic. Of course, most people in Iran are young, but we didn't find large or significant differences between the age groups.
Just on this point, because it was Ken's polling data that reminded me the extent to which, you know, the Iranian age distribution is sort of like a boa constrictor that swallowed a small goat. They had this huge it's true. They had this huge population boom after the revolution. So what you have in these numbers are you have 50% of the population between 18 and 34. Right? They actually have smaller numbers of kids in elementary and high school and then you get to this huge university, post-university population, the people who can't find jobs, right? And I think that sort of exacerbates some of the economic problems, is you have a whole bunch of people who for years have been getting out of university. A lot of women have been getting out of university, and there aren't jobs for that whole cohort. And then the people running the government are at the other end, the other skinny end of this population distribution of the people who are, you know, 60 and over. So it's again, another reason why even for stuff that you know, reading Ken's poll reminds you of stuff that you used to know and sort of updates you and gives you this very interesting picture of what's actually happening in the world.
Let me just add one point. This term pro-American, remember in a poll, you're not asking whether you like Americans, whether you support the policies of President Bush, whether you believe you should have an American political system, whether you should copy the American economy. It's a very general question, and it is a broad indicator of attitudes, and it cannot be parsed out to support very specific points about what you mean by pro-American. One other caution here about reactions to leaders, let us remember our own public opinion polls. We are in a race between the presidency and the Congress to see who can become the most unpopular. And when you actually look at our public opinion polls, they tend to be more negative toward American public leadership in America than Iranians may be toward Iran's political leadership in Iran. The causes are, of course, very different. But again, context and poll results is critical. Questions? Front row, please.
Thank you. I'm Dave Pollack from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. It's very interesting. I wanted to ask just on methodology. One thing that strikes me is the very low apparent number of don't knows, people who respond to the poll, but then when you ask them specific questions, say, I don't know. And in many Arab and other Muslim polls that I've seen, those numbers are up in the 30, 40, 50% range. Here they seem to be in the very low double digits. So I wonder if you have any thoughts about that. And similarly, whether Iranians have caller ID. Do they know where these calls are coming from? Do they know it's from a foreign country? How do you select?
Dave,
this is all just quick.
Yeah, I understand, but one question.
Okay. All right. That's it.
All right. Well, yes, some Iranians have caller ID, and the don't knows reflect. That's so. You're right. In other polls, sometimes the don't knows are higher. They were pretty low in this poll. Matt, did you want to add anything to that? Matt is Matt Warshaw from D3 Systems.
Thank you. I would just add that in some other places, don't knows are also very low. The poll we did for ABC News in Iraq had low don't know responses. I think some of it has to do with how questions are written and framed. If they're fairly straightforward, a lot of people will just give an answer. But our experience has been that there hasn't been a giant unwillingness not to answer things. And some people do have caller ID, but we do calling from areas that I don't think it bothers people as much.
Let me just point out that there are a number of people from D3 here. Some of you may have technical questions. It'll be easy to follow them up after the session, and I certainly would encourage you to do so. Second row over there.
Al Milliken, Washington Independent Writers. Relating to the Americans being detained by the Iranian government, was there any insider revelation your polling exposed? How aware are the Iranian people of the most recent accusations and detention of Americans? And back when our media was claiming Iran was holding America hostage, how do Iranians view that time in history? Do we know?
This is going to be a quick answer. We didn't ask about that, so we don't know.
All right.
Next.
In the back, please.
Hi, Artir Afkami, Middle East Institute. I've conducted field research in Tehran, Iran, in Persian. So I also have some experience in this field. My question is this. Recognizing that the U.S. or the Iranian people have a pretty strong distrust of the American government at this point, based on the ship question and most likely also on the Hezbollah support, does it not make sense to then switch to more carrot-based initiatives rather than creating more and more sticks that would push the Iranian people to distrust the government even further?
I'm going to let John begin with that one.
First, I think Ken had it right, that what it suggests to me is that broader international action makes more sense, I think, on both carrots and sticks. Right? I mean, I've spoken to a number of Chinese officials and folks in think tanks who are pretty alarmed at Iranian saber rattling. And I think you can build a sort of international coalition. Ultimately, I think that's more effective, both on the positive and negative side, with Iran. I think the other thing is there are a lot of incentives having to do with WTO accession, other things that ultimately end up pushing U.S. interests more than they hurt it, and yet the U.S. keeps holding this back as the next wonderful gift we're going to give to the Iranians. It's what, when I was in the State Department, people sometimes referred to as a Trojan carrot. And I'm not quite sure why we're still having a debate about whether we should do this. It seems to me to be kind of a no-brainer. What we saw in this poll is a lot of skepticism about anything the U.S. does on the carrot side or the stick side. And I don't think that suggests that we should go soft right now. In fact, some Iranians have told me that they think there's a real danger that if the U.S. were to be much more malleable now, it would really reward hardliners and reward Ahmadinejad for being tough and saying, see, this is the way we get things out of the world. We do brinksmanship on the nuclear negotiations, do brinksmanship with the United States, and then people give us concessions. That should mean we should steel ourselves rather than give in. I think there's some wisdom to that. I don't see a lot of urgency in fixing the broader issue of bilateral relations, and I think we should probably defer some of that until the Iranians are seeing a little more urgency on their side.
Just to follow up on what John said, I think if you offer carrots without concessions, they're always out there. They're always an incentive. They're always an argument for people to listen to you. We are not terribly good at articulating or reiterating carrots. We are very good at articulating and reiterating sticks. I think, too, that when you look at this, part of the resolution that was passed offered very significant carrots, not just restrictions on Iran's nuclear efforts. I'm referring to the UN resolution. One problem is we haven't used that well enough. We haven't publicized it enough, talked about it. And I think this is just sort of a general rule. The point you raise is a valid one. I wouldn't give up on sticks with this regime. I certainly wouldn't offer concessions, but I think a better, more aggressive diplomatic use of carrots would be a very wise thing to attempt.
And I think this poll shows the Iranian people would be receptive to that as well.
Okay. Young lady in the second row.
Hi, Jane Mossbacher, State Department. I have a question about I think you said that two-thirds of the people are sympathetic to Hezbollah and Hamas. I'm wondering how y'all would suggest the U.S. government approaching that fact.
Well, I'll be brief. Two-thirds of the people in our poll stated they favor support financial assistance to Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iraqi Shiite militia, and one-third saw that as a priority. I don't know, John or Tony, if you want to follow up on that.
I don't think that's something that we're going to be able to reach into Iranian society and change. I think it's just an important indicator, I think, that we have assumed that there's an incipient similarity of worldview between us and the Iranians. The only thing standing between us and a good bilateral relationship is this miserable government. And then we'll all see eye to eye, and we really agree on all sorts of things. I think the fact is we don't agree on all sorts of things, that there are many Iranians who support the government's paranoia, many Iranians who support the government's worldview, that our sense that, that everybody in Iran has deep distrust for the government and is cynical about all this money going overseas. I mean, as I said, there are newspaper articles about this. It sort of feeds a notion of where Iranians' heads are that is not borne out by the poll. And as Tony said, and I think there's a huge amount of truth to this, that our interlocutors tend to be people who are elites who believe they should have more power than they do, and they tend to be more in opposition to the status quo than the broader population. And I think we need to recalibrate what we're doing and our expectations for the effects of what we do based on the real sense that, I mean, a lot of Iranians say, yeah, the world's against us. The world is trying to screw us. The governments are trying to invade us. And anybody who supports resistance, who supports, you know, sticking it to the status quo, is okay. And on the broad basis of the Iranian population, there's considerable emotional support for that kind of approach to the rest of the world.
I think, you know, one obvious answer to your question is that an active peace process is one thing that might diminish this feeling. I think another is that if you can find ways to deal with the West Bank, with the Palestinian movements, which are ones we can support and make them more visible, and above all, actually have things show up as distinguished from having pledges of aid, that might help a little. But consider the reality here. Iranians not only see a media which is almost exclusively designed to support the image of the Hezbollah and Hamas, to some degree at least, as being carrying out a legitimate cause, you can't visit Iran without being aware that Iranians have an amazing number of satellites, even in relatively poor areas, and in spite of the government's effort sometime to suppress them. But they are probably not watching any of the American public diplomacy media, which seems to be popular in the region only in its own statistics. What they probably are watching is a great deal of Arab media. And guess what Arab media says about Hamas and the Hezbollah? And I think these are images we simply have to understand. It's a very one-sided picture we can't shape by having transmittals from the West Coast or by having something like Al Hurra. It's a reality we have to live with.
Having said that, still, though, there's a contradiction in the poll because 55% of Iranians in the context of renewed relations with the United States would support recognizing Israel. So there's some contradictions there.
I don't really think there are contradictions, Ken. I think the recognizing Israel under what conditions?
Under a Palestinian state.
Peace under what conditions? Out of the Israelis you pull who would give up the Golan, as long as that's the only question you ask, you get significant reactions. But Israelis care very deeply what that would actually mean, how much security and under what conditions, and the people who support it. And this is part of the problem. There are limits to how much you can draw from this. There's a question in the far back over there.
I'm Diane Perlman. I'm a social scientist.
Could you wait for the mic? And
thank you. I'm Diane Perlman. I'm a social scientist, and I study enemy images, cycles of terrorism, and conflict transformation. So first of all, thank you very much for your work. I think this is very important to get out in the field. And from what we're observing, I think we're gripped in a cycle of, you know, what I call self-fulfilling paranoia, that we act out of fear and we provoke fear in them. And actors are more dangerous when they're afraid. We're more dangerous when we're afraid and also when we're humiliated. And I think it's also important to look at the dynamics of the effect of U.S. policy on their attitudes. For example, after 9/11, Iranians were having candlelight vigils in the streets all over. They were helping us with intelligence with al-Qaeda. In 2003, they made an offer to the U.S., and they agreed to accept Israel and to defund Hamas and Hezbollah. So when we rejected them, we...
Can we get to the question?
I think that... what your work is helpful in reducing, that we need to do more tension reduction, and are you including any strategies from the field of conflict transformation, tension reduction in your work?
Yeah. Any comment?
No. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much. Let's see. What in the middle, second row.
Hi, my name is Cecilia Snyder. I'm with Our Voices Together, and I just want to follow up on the reiterating the carrot kind of idea. Do you think that U.S. policies should support citizen diplomacy as a way to engage with Iranian people more positively, like supporting Americans, volunteering overseas, adopting sister schools, that kind of thing, more of the soft stuff that there is media for public diplomacy, but sort of putting our money where our mouth is, you know, like real actions on the ground that show that we care and that we understand them and that we are interested in learning more about their culture.
John, do you want to?
That sort of stuff is very useful. I wonder about the issue of scale. I mean, given the size of the issues, given where we're starting from, at what scale, for what duration of time would you have to do that to start moving some of these numbers? I think that is a question probably you can answer better than I can, because I think you have more experience looking at this in a diverse number of places and seeing what kinds of effects it has. But it seems to me as sort of the keystone of a real broad shift that's probably not of sufficient weight to really move the whole relationship as an adjunct to a whole range of other things. I think it could be very helpful and should be encouraged.
I think John hits on a key point. The problem always with people to people is how many people do you influence and who are the people and what is the end result? And, for example, Rob Southoff at the Washington Institute is focused on the value potentially of strengthening American schools in countries overseas, on the value of academic exchanges. I think a lot of other people have seen that if you pick the right people on visitors programs, if these are people who have actual influence or people who teach, people who are in the media, it can have a very powerful impact. But the danger of this is that you have to be able to reach people, and you have to reach a lot of people effectively, and what you cannot afford to do is simply have the converted meet with the converted. And I do have to say, very often, unfortunately, dialogue programs are dialogue between people who have already agreed to talk and that they share common values. And then they repeat by going to conference-building measures. It's hard to be efficient about this, but if you're not efficient, it ends up being good intentions without a result. Second row over there.
Thanks. My name is Joanne Thornton. I'm with the Stanford Group Company. And I wanted to ask about prospects for the Iranian people to exercise these opinions, excuse me, in the next election cycle in Iran, given all the constraints of the current system. And one of the reasons I ask is that I read a report several weeks ago. I don't know if it was accurate, but it was a report that said the Majlis had supported a proposal to consolidate the next presidential and parliamentary elections so that they would both take place in the fall of 2008, which presumably, because of the size and importance of the election, would draw a lot of people to the polls. So any thoughts about prospects for election change? Thanks.
Elections in Iran are interesting because there's sort of two sets, maybe three sets of negotiations that take place. You know, there's who's actually allowed to run in the elections. There's sort of how they're allowed to run, and then there's the actual voting part. And I think that you have to make it through all three stages to win. A lot of people are knocked out in stage one or stage two. Mohammad Khatami was elected as a sort of surprise protest vote, which shows that there's still some unpredictability in elections. I think there's no question, as we look at other indicators in Iran, that opposition to the president seems to be rising. Monica Maggioni, who's a fellow with us right now, has a very interesting piece on the web in Foreign Policy, arguing that actually the conservatives like Mohammad Khalibaf and Larijani, the negotiator, are seeming to outflank the radicals like the president and suggesting that, that the president will be taken down a notch either before the elections or at the elections, certainly won't be reelected. It's hard to read all this stuff, and it's hard to see how it plays out. I think that from my reading of it, the leader hasn't completely lost patience with the president. That is, Khamenei has not decided the president is a liability. In fact, if anything, the president's ham-handedness starts making conservatives look pretty moderate, which is not totally opposed to their views. So I think they're all going to play this a little bit longer. I don't think we're my reading is that we're not yet at this moment of crisis. But the president is being political, and the leader's being political, and the other guys are being political, and they're going to keep being political. And I think that the important thing to keep in mind is what can we figure out about what's happening with these other two stages of actual electoral victory. I think politics are going to get an awful lot more interesting over the next year and a half, even than they've been for the last year and a half.
I'd agree with John, but I guess I would bet a modest amount of money that by the time the election rolls around or elections, there will be even more selectivity as who's allowed to run, more constraints on who can actually participate in the political process, more review. And the people who will tend to be pushed out are the people who are the people who supported Khatami or the people who might support a more reform-oriented structure, and the people who will survive may not agree with each other, but they will be more conservative. I hope that isn't the case. It is a guess, not a prediction. But things have not been going well inside Iran recently, and it isn't just a matter of votes. It's a matter of intimidation, threats, and arrests. And that, I think, is because there are a lot of people in Iran who, if this was a real democracy, would probably produce different political results for all the reasons John's outlined. Let's see, we're getting down toward the end, but we have time for a few more questions. The gentleman in the second row there.
Thank you very much for your comments. My name is Akash Duprani. I'm from the Canadian Embassy. Now, many scholars have stated that the base of pro-American support in Iran is based on the fact that the Americans are not engaging the Iranian leadership, which the Iranians see as repressive. And this argument follows that if we start engaging the Iranian government, then we'll lose support of the people. Can you comment on this?
Well, let me just make one comment on that, which is to follow up what people said earlier. It's not just a matter of engagement. What our poll shows, that is, if the United States can effectively articulate and put forward the carrots in a more forceful manner and demonstrate by, it's not just the micro level of exchanges that are important, it's on the ground and tangible ways that that can benefit the Iranian people. If that's more out in the forefront and not just the sticks, that could make a difference. That would be my point.
I didn't see this sort of. I mean, what you're describing is the conventional wisdom that because we are with the we're with the Iranian people against a repressive government, the people are with us, and we can just sort of push the government more. The people will get more with us, and then the whole thing will tip over, and you know. The happy days will be here again. And I thought the poll was fascinating in that it painted a very different kind of picture. In fact, as I say, on the issues like support for Hamas and Hezbollah, what it suggests to me is that this is a population which is very skeptical of the outside world, especially Western powers. This is a population that supports the Iranian government against foreign governments, and that they feel that the world is giving them a short shrift, especially on issues like nuclear energy. That's, I think, a very different kind of picture than the one that we mostly hear. And I think it does suggest a different kind of approach, and we need to have a different set of expectations for the areas where we should push the Iranian government and what kinds of popular results we would have. And then I think you have to bear in mind Tony's very important admonition that the people who act, the elites that really matter, are elites who are almost completely untouched by these polls. And they have a different set of opinions as well.
There's also a fact. You know, I think one of the dangers about this is that somehow nations talk to nations in very broad general terms, and it is simply a matter of misunderstanding, and that if we only talked more with each other in broad terms, we'd understand each other better. Now, that may be true, but let's consider the reality of U.S. and Iranian relations. We're talking about perceptions in Iran of what's happening in Iraq, perceptions of what's happening in Afghanistan, perceptions of how we're dealing with the nuclear issue, perceptions of what's happening in Lebanon, perceptions of the American alliance with Israel, perceptions of the Palestinians. We're also talking about issues which are extraordinarily difficult to move forward on, because it isn't a matter of do Americans like Iranians and Iranians like Americans. We're really talking about an Arab-Israeli peace process, which involves a whole group of extremely difficult issues. The whole problem of Iran's military actions, its nuclear issue, as well as asymmetric forces in support of terrorists and extremists. We're talking about Iran's presence in Iraq. And none of these are warm and fuzzy, and none of them are things that you can parse out without having separate perceptions and polls about what various Iranians think about these individual issues as distinguished from their overall perception of the United States, which is everything from rock music to the president in vague and general ways. Let's see, ladies and gentlemen, let me just, one last question, and I'm going to split the difference. The man with the yellow tie.
Simon Shercliffe from the British Embassy. You talk very eloquently there about perceptions, and I want to bring up another point that we've been discussing a lot. You've been discussing a lot about the carrot business. What exactly is it that the US and the West are giving Iran or offering Iran alongside the various sticks that are on offer? I think the point that I want to make and the comment that I'd like to ask for is it is very easy for your average Iranian to listen and hear the stick. Listen to and hear the stick. It's very difficult for them to actually hear what the carrot is. And there is a very good carrot out there in the nuclear negotiation. The offer that was put on the table back in August of 2006 covers an awful lot of different issues that the average Iranian, I'm sure, would be very interested in if they heard it. Now, one of these problems, again, has come up earlier, is the business about communicating from here, from the US, from Europe into Iran. That is very difficult. I appreciate that there's a lot more work that can be done about that. But a question really on the polling side, did you dig into exactly what sort of measure of trust the Iranian people have in the news that they listen to?
That was not asked specifically. We did not delve into that. I would just add, and by way of summary, what you see in the poll is very clear, that there is, as John and Tony pointed out, a great deal of skepticism towards the United States. There's skepticism towards foreign intervention. There's clearly a nationalist feeling. There's also a great desire, primarily based on economic needs, to reach out to the West and to China and to other nations, to open up trade, to have economic advancement. The level of unemployment and underemployment in Iran is huge. There are people with university degrees, women who stay at home. who don't have opportunities. There's a palpable desire that springs out from the survey of people who want a different economic life and who also want a different kind of a government than they have. So I think as the United States approaches, it would behoove us and with the international community and with France and other nations that might have more credibility inside Iran to make very clear in a demonstrable way what kind of carrots, what kind of economic advancement we could offer.
Let me just make a general comment. I think sometimes people have the impression that what's changed in this region is either the internet or satellite television, and it has suddenly made a breakthrough and opened up communications. And to some extent, that has helped. But anyone who visited this region in the early 60s knows there is this little device known as the transistor shortwave radio. And the truth is, there hasn't been a single country here that has been able to control the media in the sense of access for its elites since that appeared. It has certainly been an issue where you could hear, before the 67 war, people in regions which had very different propaganda lines listening to the BBC or whatever. It was certainly true in Iraq during Saddam Hussein, and particularly during the Iran-Iraq War. Almost everybody would tune in to foreign broadcasting who was in the sort of power structure, and there really wasn't that much suppression of it. So I don't think it's access to communication, particularly among elites, that is the problem. It is, A, what do you communicate, and then, B, competition. And what really has changed is there's a lot of alternative to the state media from local media now, and that's having a lot more penetration. But unfortunately, that's a survey which I find the data on is so self-serving among many of the various media sources that I'm going to put a lot more credence in Ken's polls than I am in the polls of who listens to what that are coming out of the region. Ladies and gentlemen, let me just give Ken a last opportunity to sort of sum up if he wishes, or John, and Ken?
Well, I think this has been a good discussion. I do agree with Tony. I think the data is very important. There are a lot of subtleties. There is a message coming out of here, and I think it's a message of what people really, as Tony mentioned before, there's a common humanity that's clear from this poll, and I think as we proceed with a very difficult regime and in a very difficult situation with a clear intention to arm itself with nuclear weapons, we need to start to take advantage of the public opinion, of the people of Iran, to reach out for them in tangible, positive economic aid, and with our allies and with other nations that are not always allied with us, such as China. The Iranians see the Chinese, they see the prosperity that's growing in China. They want that too. And I think we need to respond to that. It may be a way of diffusing the nuclear crisis in terms of weapons versus energy.
John? Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me just have this last word. Thank you very much for coming. I hope that this is a demonstration. We have a very important tool here. It's one of many, and like all tools, it has to be used well. But I do think it's produced some very important insights, and I hope you will take the opportunity to follow up Ken on his website and D3 and look through this results in detail. But again, thank you very much for coming.